On the program this afternoon, Democratic vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine on jobs, his running mate's speeches, and what happens if they win. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 18th of October. Good to have you along, everybody, as it always is. Tim Kaine was in Detroit, Michigan today, a city that's kind of become the bipartisan default backdrop for political speeches about this economy. The Democratic nominee for vice president was talking this afternoon about poverty and how a Clinton-Kaine administration might work to end it. Senator Kaine, welcome to the program, sir.
Kai, great to be with you today. Thanks.
Right at the top of your speech today, sir, you were talking about the commitment that Secretary Clinton and yourself are making toward jobs in this economy as part of a way to wipe out poverty. What then is a good job? What makes a good job, as far as you're concerned?
You know, it's something that satisfies you, but it is also something that enables you to have financial success, raise a family, and have a secure retirement. So the wage level is really, really important. And we got to make sure that we increase the number of jobs. And President Obama, we've seen a growth of jobs by 15 million in the private sector, but we still got a long way to go. And we need to see wages going up because that's what it takes to get people out of poverty.
I want to turn, if I might, sir, to the Secretary's Goldman Sachs speeches that came out over the weekend on WikiLeaks. And I understand the campaign is not going to authenticate them, but I do have to ask you, it sure looks like a whole lot of daylight between what the Secretary was saying in these private speeches 3 years ago and what she said during the primaries and even today on the campaign trail. And I wonder if that helps you understand why some people look at her and your campaign and say, we don't know what she's going to do, actually, about trade or Wall Street regulations or those kinds of things.
Well, I mean, people are asking questions of both candidates about trade and about Wall Street, certainly. Let's just talk about Wall Street regulation. I have been a strong supporter in the Senate for Dodd-Frank and maintaining regulations to make sure that Wall Street can no longer tank the American economy through kind of being unbridled and unleashed. And Hillary and I both share that, and we definitely believe in Dodd-Frank and in trying to make it stronger. You don't have to guess to know what the other side's position is. They want to repeal Dodd-Frank. And that would expose the American economy to major, major problems. And so fair questions to ask of both sides, but there's a huge difference between the two tickets on Wall Street regulation.
Well, sir, I get that. But Secretary Clinton said in one of those speeches, listen, I think we need an insider to help us regulate Wall Street. And I would bet you that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren would say, yeah, no, we don't need too many more insiders.
Well, look, the issue, but she was talking about regulating Wall Street. She was not talking about deregulating Wall Street. She was not talking about no holds barred or repealing existing regulations. You know, people who have experience in the industry are often necessary and helpful to help you tailor what the regulations are that are going to enable you to have the effect that you want to have. You want to avoid unforeseen consequences, but the appropriate level of regulation is what we are seeking, and we're going to resist any effort to do what the Trump ticket wants to do, which is to repeal Dodd-Frank.
Do you see a way, if I could shift to global trade here quickly for a second, because I know your time is tight. Do you see a way that the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which Secretary Clinton was for when she was Secretary of State and now is opposed to, as are you, is there a way it could be amended or changed that she would be in favor of it?
I can't see it right now. As you know, I voted to give the president the ability to do fast track, to negotiate the best deal possible. Every president since Gerald Ford has had that power, and I think it's a power you ought to give to the president. But when we had that vote back in the summer of 2015, I and some others who voted to do it laid out some criteria. We want to see a deal that looks like this. I had some very particular concerns about the enforcement mechanisms. What fast track does, Kai, as you know, is it requires an up or down vote. No amendments, no committee process. It's an up or down vote in Congress about this. And there's just too many problems with the deal that was negotiated on the table for us to support it. So we're going to vote. I have a vote as a senator, at least, you know, as long as I'm in the Senate, and I'm going to vote no. It's an up or down vote, and it just doesn't meet the standard that we put on the table, which is, does the deal increase jobs, increase wages? Is it good for national security? And then also, can you enforce it? Especially on the enforcement side, it's very, very weak.
To the future now, sir, and what happens should you and Secretary Clinton win come November? You said this today, quote, "This is a momentous time in America. We're going through a real test of our values and our commitment to one another." You will, and Secretary Clinton will, if you win, have to deal with a not small part of the electorate that feels disenfranchised, that feels they have been cut out of the economy, and that has been warned that you are not going to act in their best interests. What are you going to do about that?
Guy, that's a big one. And Hillary and I, you know, we had a number of to-dos already on the list, but especially the way the Trump campaign in the last few days has been trying to question the legitimacy of the election, this to-do has gotten more important. But we've been an economy where increases in the GDP are not accessible by everybody. And if you have points on the GDP growing up, but a lot of people don't see the ladder for success for themselves, they are going to be frustrated. They are going to be concerned. I see this in Virginia. I talked today in the speech about I was a civil rights lawyer for 17 years. Mm-hmm. I care deeply about the equity issue. And then I was a mayor and governor and care deeply about making economic development deals and growing the economy. We have to put a plan on the table that can create a more shared notion of prosperity. And that will speak very clearly to some folks who feel cut out. If we do it, it will speak to their condition. And I think we'll be able to work together.
A question about your parents, sir, if I might. Your father ran an ironworking workshop. Your mother taught home ec.
Yep.
They've been out on the campaign trail with you. Do you think they could make it in today's economy?
Guy, that's a great question. I think my folks would have done exactly what they did 55 years ago. My mom was a home ec teacher for a while until the three boys came in quick order. And then later she worked in food service for a while. She would have done the same thing. And my dad definitely would have done what he did. He started off working with larger businesses. But then, you know, just there's that entrepreneurial gene. You want to have your own thing. I think some of the challenges that small business owners have today, if my dad was doing it today, getting access to capital. You know, mm-hmm. if you don't have your own track record of running a business, can you get the capital? And that's why Hillary and I have made this fourth pillar of our plan, small business success, because she came out of a small business household just like I did. And these were not businesses that were household names, but they were businesses that put, you know, my dad's kids and his workers' kids through school and made a dignified living for them. And so I know he'd be trying to do the same thing. Hillary and I want to have an economy where the folks who have that dream and want to own their own business, where they can do it.
Senator, thanks very much for your time. Sir Tim Kaine, Senator from Virginia, Democratic candidate for the vice presidency of the United States. Have a good day, sir.
All right, Kai, thanks.
I have said this before, but it does bear repeating. Donald Trump and his running mate, Indiana Governor Mike Pence, have a standing invitation and have had for some time a standing invitation to come on this radio program. On Wall Street today, big banks led the way. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The story of organized labor in this economy the past, couple of decades, probably more, has been about its decline, about falling membership and falling influence. All of that might be true, but unions in this country still have a whole lot of money, and they are spending it this year on politics. A story in the Wall Street Journal this morning caught our eye. The AFL-CIO has doubled its campaign spending over this time in the 2012 cycle, same for some other big unions. And it's no secret that labor generally supports the Democrats. This time, though, they're looking down ballot, way down ballot. Gigi Duban has more.
Union reps are already in battleground states from Ohio to Wisconsin, doing what they do best, knocking on doors, making calls, handing out leaflets at factories. And over the coming weeks, voters in those states can expect an even bigger push.
The final 3 weeks of this campaign, we are going to step up in major ways.
Josh Goldstein is a spokesman for the AFL-CIO. He says, yes, they're supporting Democrat Hillary Clinton, but also
all the way down ballot to local elections that really shape policy for people in their communities.
Races from governor to Senate. The idea, he says, is to tip the balance on policies that matter to unions. Nelson Lichtenstein is director of the Center for the Study of Work, Labor, and Democracy at UC Santa Barbara.
And where you have Republican governors and Republican legislatures. You get right-to-work laws. You get the failure to expand Medicaid.
All things labor unions don't like. Also, the Senate approves presidential appointees to key agencies, like the National Labor Relations Board, or NLRB. John Budd is a professor at the University of Minnesota.
And there's been a lot of obstructionist efforts to, you know, try to stop the NLRB from being funded or fully funded, try to stop it from having enough appointees.
And it's not just the NLRB. Unions care a lot about who's in charge at the Labor Department and any other agency that weighs in on issues important to workers. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
We're digging into the results of our latest Marketplace Edison Research economic poll this week. This time around, we asked about fear, about how afraid people are that this election is going to hit them right in the wallet. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ganser is on that one.
More than half the people in our poll said they think the presidential election will affect their personal financial situation. Close to 80% of them use the word afraid. People like Ralph Baldy, a Donald Trump supporter who's petrified that Hillary Clinton will win.
Because she's talking about taxes on taxes on taxes. And where is that going to leave me? It's going to be standing on a street corner trying to sell pencils.
Baldy is 62. From Memphis, Tennessee. He's afraid of cuts in his disability payments. And then there's 30-year-old Zachary Stern Shea, a law student and Clinton supporter.
I would be afraid that if Trump won, I would lose my health insurance. He has threatened to immediately dismantle the Affordable Care Act.
Robert Walker owns a small software business in Seattle. He's an independent, afraid of both Clinton and Trump. With Trump,
he said that he wants to put a 25% tariff on goods coming in from China. China is our number one state trading partner in Washington.
Walker's fear with Clinton? Immigration. Getting enough skilled IT workers in the U.S.
There are no specifics in Clinton's proposals around what comprehensive immigration reform actually means.
In fact, when I talked to Walker, he was interviewing software developers in Bulgaria. Everybody I talked to traces their economic fears back to what Walker said. There are so few specifics in this campaign. So how can you blame them for being afraid? That's what Jim O'Sullivan says. He's chief U.S. economist at High Frequency Economics. He says the candidates are fanning the flames of fear with negative talk about the economy.
From the Trump side, it's a pretty clear story that the economy is a disaster. Now, from the Clinton perspective, also, she, I think, talks about inequality a lot.
O'Sullivan says the candidates figure all the negative talk gives people a reason to vote for them so they can fix all of the economic problems they've campaigned on. He says they think fear about the economy is a good motivator at the polls. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
We've got all the data from our survey on our website. It's marketplace.org. Dig in, go crazy, see what you can see. Also, while you're there, give a look at our Economic Anxiety Index and take our quiz. See where you fall on the anxiety scale. The battle for Mosul, the second largest city in Iraq, is now in its second day. Iraqi government troops and Kurdish Peshmerga fighters, backed up by American ground troops, are still on the outskirts of that city. It's going to be a military fight against ISIS, of course. That group has controlled the city for the past 2 years. But Mosul is an economic target as well, as Marketplace's Andy Euler explains.
The U.S. Treasury Department says the Islamic State pulled in about $1 billion last year, half from oil and gas revenue, more than a third from taxing and extorting people in places it controls, places like Mosul. Bilal Wahab, a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, says Mosul has certainly been a cash cow for ISIS.
When we look at ISIS incorporated at large, not just ISIS Iraq, freeing Mosul from ISIS will actually translate into a tremendous economic hit to ISIS finances.
That's part of the strategy of the U.S.-led coalition. ISIS would need to rebuild its financing if it loses Mosul. Iraq's government, for its part, would have to rebuild roads, sanitation, and power facilities.
There's going to be a huge rebuilding job to do in Mosul. The price tag easily could go into the billions.
That's Robert Ford, a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington. He says that's a tall order for Iraq's government right now.
With low oil prices, worldwide, the Iraq government will be really challenged to come up with money.
Another challenge? The UN estimates as many as 200,000 people may be forced to flee the fighting in Mosul. Some say that's a conservative number. That says aid agencies are already scrambling to cope with a global refugee crisis. Joe Nye is a professor at Harvard Kennedy School of Government.
There has not been adequate treatment of refugees in the Middle East. And so if you ask, will this all turn out neatly, it would be remarkable in terms of what's happened in the rest of the region.
So what can the U.S. do? Stuart Bowen was the U.S. Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. He says to avoid wasting taxpayer dollars, as has happened in the past, we have to think very strategically before making any moves.
You have to secure a zone before you can begin to rebuild it. And I think too much money was lost during Iraq Reconstruction because of rebuilding that occurred in very unstable zones.
Bowen says recapturing and rebuilding Mosul won't wipe out ISIS, but could be a step in that direction. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I was with Chase. They can be inconvenient at some times.
When your bank just doesn't get you. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 75 points today, 0.4%, finished at 18,161. The NASDAQ up 44 points, 0.8%, wrapped at 5243. The S&P 500 stepped up 13 points, about 0.6%, 21.39. Netflix cranked up 19% today after the company said it gained far more subscribers in the last quarter than it anticipated. Amazon up about 0.5% today. United Health got a shot in the arm after it reported a healthy quarter. Shares up nearly 7%. Harley Davidson roared up 9% on news it plans to reorganize and reduce its workforce. Johnson & Johnson posted some solid earnings, but still slipped 2.5%. IBM gave back 2.6% today after it said profit margins shrank for the fourth quarter in a row. That's never good. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.74%, and you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Thanks to the good people at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, we got the latest figures on inflation in this economy this morning. Prices were up just about as much as the experts had been guessing, 1.5% or so over a year ago. It was the usual culprits leading the way, gas and housing, but deep down in the data was something kind of interesting. Prescription drug prices are up 7% over the past year, the biggest annual bump since 1992. From the Health Desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has that one.
So we're seeing a historic price spike, but health policy people aren't exactly sure what's behind it. Yale economist Fiona Scott-Morton thinks a new class of powerful drugs, sometimes called biologics, could be helping fuel costs. These are treatments for conditions like MS and rheumatoid arthritis.
Autoimmune diseases, cancer drugs, and they're often really quite expensive, $100,000 a year, $200,000 a year.
Scott Morton says manufacturers have been aggressively raising their prices on these potent drugs, sometimes by double digits. Controversial business practices like this have landed some companies in the spotlight, like Mylan, the makers of EpiPen. Dr. Waleed Jalad at the University of Pittsburgh sees a connection between those scandals and a political shift.
A piece of what we're seeing may be an anticipation from industry that the end is coming. And at some point, they're not going to be able to increase prices the way that they have.
These higher drug prescription prices could be the harbinger of rough times ahead. Since the recession and the rise of Obamacare, overall healthcare spending growth, that's prices and utilization, has been historically low. But Paul Hughes Cromwick at the healthcare research organization Alterum Institute says the days of moderate spending growth may be over.
We see some writing on the wall that might presage a return to the bad old days.
Not only would the bad old days mean it's harder to pay for our care, Hughes Cromwick says it also means healthcare costs eating up more of our economy, leaving less money on the table for everything else. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
The third quarter of the year is proving to have been very, very good for the big Wall Street banks. Goldman Sachs reported BAFO profits this morning. Bank of America, Citigroup, and JPMorgan Chase have already done the same. Lots of money to be made if you're big enough and in the right kinds of the banking business, it seems. Low-income Americans, though, can feel invisible to those big banks with their tendency to focus on wealthier or at least not poor customers. Changing that is the focus of a joint project between Chase and the nonprofit Center for Financial Services Innovation. The bank has committed $30 million over 5 years, money that includes support for startups that are trying to address some of the financial challenges faced by low and moderate income Americans. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has that story from New York.
One of the startups JPMorgan Chase is mentoring is called B. Today, the team is at work in Harlem, signing up new customers one block at a time. The sales team stands out in bright yellow shirts.
The Beehive, it's live. We got a lot of people joining our swarm.
B isn't technically a bank, but it offers low-cost financial services similar to checking and savings accounts, including reloadable debit cards and mobile check deposits. B salesperson Amina Brown explains the product to Delroy Jones.
Now, B gives you two options. You can have immediate availability, which means that the check will clear, the entire check will clear within 30 minutes.
He tells me later that he signed up because depositing using his smartphone saves him the wait on a check cashing line. The fees are lower, too.
You can't beat that. You're not going to find that nowhere. So I take it.
That's one kind of customer B wants, someone outside traditional banking. But there's another group B goes after, and this is where the strange mix of big bank and startups takes a complicated turn. Here's another of B's newest customers, Aquilin Hayes.
I was with Chase. They can be inconvenient at some times.
She says she had a frustrating experience with Chase recently where money in her account wasn't immediately accessible. She called customer service and wasn't satisfied with their answer. And now she's with B. Recap, B is a tech startup that has taken Chase's money, its advice, and now trying to take its clients. At B's snug offices along a loud Midtown Avenue, I ask CEO and co-founder Vinay Patel how he squares that. It's clearly something he's thought about as he's got a little joke ready.
When we look at Chase, they spend more on candy in their national branches than our entire operating budget for the year.
But he definitely sees an opportunity for his company among current customers of major banks.
I think a healthy percentage of Americans who do have bank accounts today are ill-served by those bank accounts.
JPMorgan Chase leadership is carefully diplomatic about mentoring a potential competitor. Colleen Briggs is Executive Director of Global Corporate Responsibility.
It's not going to be an us versus them, which I know is where a lot of people focus the conversation. But actually, I think we can sort of figure out how do we leverage the best of both of us to come together to tackle these issues of financial insecurity.
Banking critics will note here that many Americans are excluded or unbanked or whatever you want to say because of Chase and the other big banks. They have few branches in low-income neighborhoods and stiff fees and rules making it difficult for many Americans to have checking accounts. Briggs's response is that Chase is thinking about low and moderate income Americans.
I would say we actually are, I think, as an institution, really thinking about ways to serve this segment. You know, we launched Liquid, which is a really strong product. It's a prepaid product, no overdraft fees, low monthly fee.
It's actually kind of like what B offers. It's a reminder that the bank's investment in financial inclusion isn't just corporate do-gooding. It's also an opportunity to learn a few things from the startups. This collaboration is an unusual approach, not guaranteed to address all the challenges low and moderate income Americans face, but it's certainly interesting to watch. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which I am once again obliged to ask, really, America? A survey out today from Influencer.com, and yes, insert appropriate caveats here about it being gimmicky and a cheap play for publicity, what have you. I am going to roll with it anyway. They surveyed people by state about their favorite Halloween candies. The candy of choice in the most number of states, and you should picture me shaking my head slowly from side to side here, is candy corn. I am reassured only in the knowledge that the treat getting the highest number of total votes was a personal favorite of mine, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 75 points today, 0.4%, 18,161. The NASDAQ gained 44 points, 0.8%, 5243. The S&P 500 up 13, 0.6%, 2139. Tommy Andres, Raghu Manavalan, and Vanessa Smith are the producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kerwa, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.